This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the latest news surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. We'll talk about the ongoing efforts to address the virus itself and the many different ways that governments, businesses, schools, and other institutions are deciding to react. We are live, so if you have questions or comments on our show today, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881 and leave a quick question or comment. We will do our best to get it in front of our panel and into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now are three guests. Shandy Dearth is Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI School for Public Health. Shandy, welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Josh Vest is an associate professor and director for the Center for Health Policy at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Good afternoon, Josh.
Howdy.
And Brian Dixon is director of public health informatics at the Regan Streef Institute and associate professor of epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here.
Shandy, we had you on a few weeks ago, and things have changed quite a bit since then in Indiana and elsewhere. What have you been working on?
So there's a lot more focus now on contact tracing, and also obviously we now have the statewide mask mandate, so that's a great public health initiative to try and keep transmission down. And as schools start to reopen, universities start to reopen, lots of people in public health right now are working on contact tracing plans and also what should happen if you have a case at a university setting or at a school setting, at a private company, that sort of thing. So that's definitely progressing right now.
I believe we heard State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box either yesterday or the day before saying we needn't worry too much about single positive tests, positive results from students at, say, a high school or a school, someone going back to school. What more can we say about that?
So I would say she's correct in that we expected to see some cases in schools as we opened it. Obviously, in March, when we realized COVID was such a problem, all of the schools quickly closed. So the kids have not been together, so we haven't seen the cases among the kids as often. But the schools have been working all summer long to come up with good plans to figure out how to cohort children. So just because you have one case in a school does not mean that all of the children would be considered a close contact of that case. And so there are great protocols in place and how to handle that, how to do the parental notification, that sort of thing with the public health officials.
Regarding contact tracing, a couple of weeks ago, we had a talk with a reporter on our show talking about how some county health officials have been frustrated with the state efforts to implement contact tracing because they have not been the county health officials were saying that they had not really been asked to help or their advice was not really taken by state officials. Have you seen that to be the case anywhere?
Well, I myself am not at a local health department currently, but I can say that the state is trying to make a system that works for all 92 counties, which is not an easy task by any means. And I understand that they are doing weekly webinars with the local health departments. They are asking for input, and I can say not every suggestion will be taken into account, at least not right away, but I know that they are constantly improving the system. And again, a lot of schools and a lot of universities are doing some of that initial internal contact tracing as well. So it definitely cannot be put on just one agency. It needs to be a team effort.
Isn't contact tracing, though, something that local health officials are sort of used to doing with other things? I mean, I guess the most recent big example would be the hepatitis C outbreak in southern Indiana.
Yes, and actually they've done a lot of contact tracing over the years for STDs, for other vaccine-preventable diseases, tuberculosis, other things. So they do have a long history of doing contact tracing at the local health departments as well.
Where are we on average positivity rate right now?
So for the state as a whole, looking at a seven-day moving average, we're looking at about 7.4%. And again, those numbers are updated each day on the State Department of Health website at noon each day.
And what does that number tell us? I mean, I've seen this 5% threshold as sort of a benchmark for needing to walk things back, shut things down, things like that. And we're just above that right now. I mean, obviously, there's a lot in play there, politics being one of them. What does 7.4% mean, I guess?
So basically, that tells us 7.4% of all of the people currently being tested are shown to be positive for an active infection. And so that tells us that there is still transmission in the area. If that number creeps up more, that's when we need to do more public health measures to try and curtail some of that increased transmission. So some of the communities are looking at setting some of those thresholds, as you said, to implement more public health measures.
Josh Vest, how would you rate Indiana right now? Is the state responding properly?
I think the state is responding. As a public health person, I'm always happy to see more public health initiatives. Unfortunately, Indiana has been very low on the totem pole for public health funding over the years. We're often ranked 48th or 49th for per capita spending for public health in the state. And I think this pandemic is kind of highlighting some of the cracks that we have in our system and that we need to work on moving forward. So I'm hoping when the pandemic settles down, more people have come to recognize the importance and the value of public health, and we put more into the infrastructure.
Josh, how about you? How are we doing? How would you say it's looking?
So I think, from across the nation, we've clearly had a resurgence coming back up, and I think that's without question. I think in terms of response, we work at the Fairbanks School of Public Health very closely with Marion County, and they've, I think, done a very good job of thinking about, how do we do appropriate measures, try to be curtailing transmission to the best of our ability, but also being attentive to the fact that there are other negative consequences associated with the outbreak and public health response, such as, economic challenges and things like that, trying to balance both of those together so it works to hopefully mitigate disease, but at the same time not create further harms. And so I think the county has been very thoughtful and very forefront and data-driven on all this aspect.
What, then, did you think of the Holcomb administration's decision to create a stage 4.5 to pause the reopening plan?
So I think pausing was the right approach. We were in a challenging space. And things needed to go back. We have active transmission within the community. There were places that increased. We are still in a space without any therapeutics really available to us. We're still without a vaccine. So we are in a world of what do you have to do to minimize transmission, and that is increase social distancing, wear face coverings, practice good hygiene, minimize large gatherings, and that was, I think, a lot of the activity that's come in to help reinforce those behaviors.
I think there would be a big blowback, a big resistance to moving backwards, say back to a stage 4 or a stage 2 or something like that. Do you see a scenario where that may very well be necessary?
So, I mean, that's always the challenge, right, in terms of any kind of, for example, public health marketing. Once you've set a benchmark and expectation and kind of, put a date on and move people forward and behaviors start to shift, it's very difficult. Nobody, I think, most people were not particularly thrilled with stay at home and increased social distancing, so they've wanted to get out more. So it's very hard to peel that behavior back. But other states are doing much more aggressive rollbacks in order to tail the disease, but they've seen more transmission than we're seeing here locally, though.
When we compare Indiana to other states, I mean, how does it look like we're doing? How does Indiana's current response to the pandemic compare to other states?
So broadly, I think from what we've seen in my center is, again, Indiana's being very thoughtful, made good data-driven decisions. It also, though, lived within the political reality of what its neighbors do as well, too. So what was feasible and necessary, say, for example, in New York or California, may not necessarily have been here, but it was much more thoughtful and much more in line with much more better public health practices than, say, for example, Florida, Texas, Georgia, places like that. And I think in Indiana, for sure, we've seen a lot more cooperation between state and locals than we have seen in other states where that's led to several problems.
Brian Dixon, you've worked on data with a team at the Regenstrief Institute. Can you talk about how that got started? What was your goal early on?
Absolutely. So our goal early on was to get information out into the hands of local public health authorities. So very early, we day-to-day work with data from the hospital system and use that data to inform clinical care through the information systems and our partners like the Indiana Health Information Exchange. And so we said, what can we do to respond to this crisis? And that was bring data and information from the healthcare system to public health and help our public health partners kind of integrate and do more with data. Because as Shandy alluded, you know, one of the challenges we have in the state is kind of a limited public health infrastructure. So we saw ourselves as being able to bring our infrastructure to help the state and the local county health departments, which are often very small, especially outside of Marion County. So we designed a set of tools that pull together information that the state shares with us, that come from the hospitals and the healthcare systems and clinics, and bring all of that data into one place so that state and county health officials could kind of look at the situation in their environment. A few weeks later, we then said, you know, we think the healthcare systems, the leaders in the healthcare systems and the public would also be interested in these data. So we then moved to make a lot of those data publicly available.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We are live today. We'd love to hear your voice in the conversation. Again, you can call 866-476-3881 and leave us a voicemail. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the latest news around the COVID-19 pandemic, and we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have with us Shandy Durth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Josh Vest is an Associate Professor and Director for the Center of for Health Policy at the IUPUI School of Public Health. And Brian Dixon is Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regenstrief Institute and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. And Brian, I'm going to stay with you. We were talking about data. Is there important data that you aren't able to get right now, or maybe data that's hard to get?
Well, certainly one of the most challenging data that we've seen across the country to get is information on race and ethnicity of individuals who are tested. I actually think this is one of the places where the state has actually excelled. We are only one of six states that is making those data available through its, you know, the public health dashboard as well as the Regenstrief dashboard. So many other states have struggled to get those data. But even though we're getting some of those data, we still have a good chunk of people who are getting tested that are have an unknown race or ethnicity. And that's really important because one of the things that public health tries to do is monitor health disparities and work with community partners to address those disparities.
Are there other groups like yours in Indiana who are aggregating and analyzing data? How is everything working together?
Yeah, so our team works incredibly close with the state with the state groups, and that this inside the state government, there's actually three groups that are working together and coordinating their activities with us. So that would be, of course, the Indiana State Department of Health, but also the Governor's Office and the Family and Social Services Administration, which manages the Medicaid health insurance program in the state. And so we are collaborating with them to try to coordinate. This is the information that's going to go kind of on the state's official website, and this is the information that is going to be put onto the Regenstrief dashboard.
I mean, there's value in redundancy to, you know, how what data is looked at, how it's analyzed. But how do we make sure that, I guess, everyone I don't know. I don't live in this world, so I don't even know if this is a valid question, but how do we make sure that everyone's working on something different so that we can kind of put it all together and draw a broader conclusion, I suppose?
That's a great question, and we actually have a response. So the CEO of Regenstrief, Dr. Peter Imby, formed what has now become known as the Indiana Pandemic Information Collaborative, which is quite a mouthful. But the that group was designed to do precisely what you asked. So it involves all those groups within the state that I mentioned. It involves community-based organizations like the Red Cross and United Way and the CHIP, which works on homelessness initiatives. It also brings together Purdue and other academic institutions. And we all, and I should mention also the health systems. So our group meets on a regular basis to talk about precisely that. What is the information that people need? Who's collecting that information? How can we make it available to the people who need it? So, for example, we had a call last week with Department of Education. They talked about the data that they're collecting. We talked about the data that's available from all these other partners, and we started talking about strategies to work together so that we can monitor different kind of school age groups over time to look at the spread of the disease amongst those groups as schools reopen, so that everyone wasn't doing exactly the same thing, but that together we were looking at those data and helping each other interpret what they mean and talk about strategies to mitigate the spread of the disease amongst kids.
Shandy Dearth, I want to talk a little more about contact tracing. And I think one of the big concerns when we started ramping up contact tracing efforts, and I think indeed we've been doing it since March in one form or another, but one of the big concerns people had was with privacy. Are those concerns founded?
So I've got to say the contact tracers handle that information from the patient just like any other protected health information. And so they are trained on PHI requirements, trained on the HIPAA rule, and the data is sent back and forth between locals and states all through a secure network. So I have very little concern, actually, about that piece of the data collection.
How is contact tracing across Marion County? What's the process like right now?
So currently what's happening is anytime anyone is tested positive for coronavirus in the state of Indiana, all of those lab results are sent to the Indiana State Department of Health. So at that point, their call center takes 48 hours to try and make multiple attempts at making a connection with that case. When they make that connection, they do the interview, they ask where that person works, where they go to school, where they've been, who they've been around, that sort of thing. And so from the interview, they collect information about close contacts, who has spent more time with that person in kind of a confined space without masks, that sort of thing. That information is then used for all of these reports that you're seeing online. If they're not able to make that connection with that case after 48 hours, it's sent to the local health department. And then that's when the local health department picks up the contact tracing. In Marion County, the nurse epidemiologist and the public health nurses at the Marion County Public Health Department have been picking up those cases. But just recently, we signed a contract through Fairbanks School of Public Health and the city of Indianapolis to give some assistance towards contact tracing inside Marion County. So right now we're ramping up, we're hiring additional contact tracers, and we will actually send contact tracers out into the field as well as just doing the phone communications, because we realize we're having an issue sometimes connecting with people over the phone, email, text, that sort of thing. So we're trying to make sure that we send people out to the field, we can connect them to social services if needed possibly, and we get the interview done as well, because we understand, especially in Marion County, we need to enable people to stay home. So perhaps they need assistance getting connected with a food bank or some other social service agency so that they can stay home and they're not going out while ill to a grocery store or some other setting.
So if you're hiring more contact tracers, then that sort of tells me that we're not quite where we need to be as far as contact tracing. But, I mean, could we ever be, really? I mean, nothing's perfect. Nothing can be perfect. Would you say that there are any big flaws that need to be addressed in the process?
There are definitely issues with communication. I know the State Department of Health is trying to really push out that number to let people know, if you get a call from this number, please answer that call. So I think sometimes, and we see this in public health, not just during the pandemic and coronavirus, people often don't want to share the information. So we just need to make more communication out there, more education out there, so that people understand we're not sharing your personal protected health information with anyone. This is truly just for public health practice and for the surveillance work so that we can find these clusters. So I think the more comfortable the public gets with us doing this work, the more likely they will be to respond to us. But we're also in Marion County. It's a very diverse group. So we're hiring more Spanish-speaking contact tracers, people from the Burmese community, and that sort of thing, to make sure that the contact tracers we have here in Marion County represent and look like the community itself.
We have a panel of public health experts on with us today to talk about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana, and we would love your input, questions, and comments. Send them to Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can do what a listener named Joshua did and give us a call at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. Let's listen to Joshua's voicemail now.
My name is Joshua from the west side of the state, Hendricks County. Just wanted to say that I politely disagree with Josh that Indiana is responding well to this. School corporations across the state are trying to do their best to follow no guidance, really, when it comes to how to safely open. New York just put a 3% positivity rate cap to say that's what it's going to take to open, and now we have schools that are neighboring doing totally different things. Why is Indiana not following the World Health Organization's 5% positivity rate to reopen?
Josh, Joshua raises an interesting point, and that 3% positivity rate cap I had not heard about. I heard the number 5%, but he's probably right. I think New York has been doing their due diligence, and we've seen some good results there. But then again, there is value in autonomy, which it seems like that's what the state is trying to give to local school corporations. Any response to Joshua, Josh?
Policy on any level is always a set of trade-offs between different options. And there is choices that are politically feasible and politically reasonable, given the broader trends both in the country and the state, and balancing that off against what is the best interest of public health. I mean, when we think about schools, there is the challenge of there is value in kids being in school. That is undeniable. It is a major source of food for many kids. So there would be hunger issues. There is a sense of safety when kids are at school and not at home. Learning is actually better at school, particularly for little kids. Now, the truth is, though, that has to be balanced against the very real issue that there will be increased transmission. And so these things have to be balanced out and put across. And again, within the context of what is politically acceptable across a wide degree of constituents and people within single schools who vary as well in terms of their opinions. So it's not as easy to say it would be one thing if we lived in a single direction kind of uniform set across schools and public health, but we don't. We are very fragmented, very diversified, and therefore it's going to almost be by default consensus and choices around at an individual local level.
There is some guidance coming down for schools from a number of different places, and that's good and bad. Good in that there's a lot and there's a diversity to it, and bad in that sometimes there's consistency issues with the information. Do you get a sense for what's going into the decisions that schools are making right now more than anything else?
So I think what's going into the decisions for schools, and we have to distinguish, I think, between institutions of higher education and high schools and younger kids. I think what a big driver for, particularly in the younger kid space, is the benefits that education gives in the school setting, right? I mentioned it again, right? These are sad things, but we saw increases in domestic violence, child abuse, elder abuse during prolonged stay-at-home orders. We saw challenges with education. We had to have schools and other community-based organizations really revamp and think about how to actually feed kids. I mean, it is, again, not to reiterate, there's a lot of kids who would go hungry if it was not for the school system. And so I think that's a lot of the motivation in some of this. Now, this is broad brush. There are people who have other motivations for having the kids go to school, but it also supports the economy in the space of it now is not parents having to watch their kids at home. So there's a lot of reasons to do this, and I think that's part of the motivation, and it's better for the education. Now, again, that's going to come with risks, and there are strategies and multiple strategies to do it to try to mitigate it, but there will be increased transmission as soon as the kids are back in school. I think that's a given. We've already seen it occur.
What do we know, and maybe this is a question for Shandy, but Josh, while I have you, what do we know about transmission between, among, I guess, younger children? There were a lot of things going out there that it's just not as, I guess, not as easy to transmit the virus between children because it's not as viable in children or something like that. What do we know?
So I will also, go ahead.
Go ahead, Josh. I was going to say some recent research is actually showing us that kids can replicate the virus, sometimes even more effectively than adults, but we're still not clear on how contagious that is. So even though they're replicating it, how does that affect transmissibility? And we're still not clear on that. But again, part of this is that the kids haven't been together as much. So we still need a little more time to figure that out as kids do start to come back together and we see some of these clusters, but we saw that cluster in that overnight summer camp in Georgia recently. So obviously kids can spread it among themselves, and that's where cohorting of students in classrooms becomes critical in controlling a possible spread through a school setting.
Josh.
Yeah, and
Go right ahead, please.
I'll just add on to what Shandy said. Completely agree, and she's correct. The other part is it's really important to know that this is a novel virus, things that we have not had much experience with, and our experience and research is coming out of a world when most kids were sent home, and that's in all countries across the world. So we've been living and studying the dynamics of transmission in a very different world that we're about to not be in again, right? We're about to switch into something that we have not been in previously. So it's hard to understand how that's going to move about too. But then also too, if we just think about it in terms of kids and high schoolers, this is one of the challenges in an infectious disease. They have much larger social networks than adults do. If we think about adults, we have social networks, and probably our biggest number of contacts during the day comes when we go to work, if we work in an office. Kids, particularly young kids, the number of contacts they have without any kind of precautions or restrictions dwarfs adults. So even if, no matter what kind of assumptions get challenged or if kids have conditions, they just come into contact with more kids than anybody else. And so there is just that increased risk of more transmission without things, as Shandy said, cohorting or podding kids and thinking about increased social distancing in confined spaces.
I guess I hadn't thought of that at all. I, you know, in learning that schools were going to be back in session, you know, with students present, and there are blended models elsewhere, I thought this is just a recipe for spreading the virus. And indeed, in some ways it may be, but I hadn't thought about the fact that social networks among children are much more limited than those of adults.
No, I'm sorry. For the no, their social networks are larger.
Oh, they're larger. Okay, I guess I misunderstood.
Yeah, so they come into in terms of social, they come into contact with more people, right? Like if you consider, just pick yourself as a representative person. If you were to go to the office, how many people you would interact with in a single room in a day? There's research studies that actually go out there and count these sorts of things. But if you'd compare the average adult to how many a kid would come across in class, particularly once you move to something like middle school where you start switching classes or you have different gym periods or go to large cafeterias or, outside in recess, all of those kind of things just exponentially increase how many different individuals a kid comes into contact with. And so that's one of the main strategies of podding or cohorting is in order to actually reduce that number of contacts and then also make it manageable in case contact tracing has to go on.
Josh Vest, thanks for clearing that up. We'll keep the conversation going after a quick break. We're talking with health experts today about the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and efforts to fight it. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the COVID-19 pandemic. As always, we would love your questions and comments if you have them. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have another listener voicemail to put in front of our panel. This one's from Thomas. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Thomas from Indianapolis, and I'm curious about the organization Reagan Street, I think it's called. And is it a nonprofit organization? Is it a governmental organization? I'm wondering if it has a contract with the state. I'm wondering where the funds come from, and I'm wondering why if they're not a state organization, why can't a state organization do the work that they're doing? I'm concerned about privatization of governmental services, and that's the reason for my question. Thank you.
Thomas, you're in luck. We have Brian Dixon with us, of course. He's Director of Public Health Informatics at the Reagan Streif Institute. Brian, can we help Thomas out?
We absolutely can. So Reagan Streif is indeed a nonprofit organization, and we are technically considered a support entity to Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine. Our normal day job is to conduct what's known as health services research, so all sorts of research projects that are designed to make healthcare delivery better. That includes the program that I direct is focused on public health informatics, which kind of takes information and computing technology to support the business of public health. So we work regularly with state and local health departments on a variety of research projects normally. Funding for the Institute generally comes from federal grants, research grants, and sometimes it comes through contracts with the State Department of Health or other entities for specific projects. So we may be working on a specific project around, for example, hepatitis C that would require perhaps a contract with ISDH. But for this pandemic, we volunteered our services back in March to help the State Department of Health. So there was no contract involved for us supporting what ISDH was doing. We have been providing those services kind of in kind since then. We are currently, of course, working with the State Department of Health, though, to pursue research grants and opportunities that have now
become available from CDC and the National Institutes for Health and others. So we're working with them as partnerships, but we were not contracted to do the specific work that we're doing.
We have a question from Kelly on Facebook who asks, at some time, will we be able to capture more data for COVID patients who are smokers or have a history of vaping? While capturing existing comorbidities seems to be pretty robust, the behavioral risk data would be nice to see in Indiana. Brian, are you the right person to throw that one to?
I'm one of them. I think all of us on the phone have been at least tangentially, if not more directly, involved in some of the statewide testing efforts that the School of Public Health has been doing with the State Department of Health. Behavioral data would be, I agree with the caller, it would be fantastic to have. There is very limited data out there today on the risks of smoking and vaping on COVID-19. So some of the evidence that's out there from other places would suggest that individuals who have a history of smoking or vaping have worse outcomes, but a lot of those data are preliminary and they're kind of small. So we would love to have those data, and one of the projects that we've been one of the things we've been talking about with our partners is potentially being able to look at those data, like link some data sets together to look at the risks of smoking. Unfortunately, it's not set up right now when people go in for testing that they necessarily get a lot of questions about their smoking history and other things. If they're going to, say, the State Department of Health testing sites or CVS or someplace to get a test, those data are not routinely captured by the laboratory that's running the test. Shandy, do you know if they're capturing those data, though, in the contact tracing efforts? Will you be capturing that for Marion County?
No, we're not asking questions like that, unfortunately. It's really relying on are really focusing on the coronavirus spread more than anything else, and it's not capturing any other kind of data fields related to that.
Brian Dixon, we have a comment from Bob on Facebook, another data comment. He says, I'm a university employee heading back to a full campus later this month. I hear there's no organized COVID-19 data collection for universities. We will also not have mandatory testing. I am very concerned. What do we know about organized data collection for universities?
Well, as Josh alluded, each university and university system is doing its own thing. And there are some recommendations that are out there from a few places on what universities at least should consider. I can tell you that my conversations with both IU and Purdue, they are both doing their best to try to set up routine surveillance of faculty, staff, and students, and also establish, for example, isolation beds on campus for students who live in the dorm. So if someone tests positive, they're taken out of the dorm and placed there to recover. All of them will be monitoring data from the surrounding communities in which their campuses are located, so they can look at community spread of the virus in addition, of course, to positive tests of their faculty and staff. Most universities are using their campus health centers to make testing available. Most universities are requiring that students receive a test and that test is negative before they can come back to campus. Some universities are testing all of the students when they arrive on campus and then isolating individuals who test positive. So there's a variety of strategies that universities are using, but I would agree with the caller that it's not uniform across all campuses.
Josh Vest, we got a question from Richard who wants to know whether pool testing is being considered, particularly in school settings. What do we know about testing pools?
So pool testing is an approach to
be more efficient with both materials and time, and to leverage the fact that, as we said earlier, you know, if you're sitting in a place where you expect 5 to 10% become back positive, that's a lot of negative tests. So if you combine samples and everybody comes back negative, you can move forward. If you combine samples and there's a positive, then you can do more intensive screening. So it's a measure of efficiency. Some places are trying that. It's a difficulty in terms of resources and what's available. As Brian just mentioned, universities which have sufficient resources to be able to launch such large-scale active surveillance and testing, they are considering those approaches and leveraging them to more routinely test students. That's a harder thing to do at a smaller school or even at a smaller location, particularly when you start dealing with those who are minors. That raises a whole host of other challenges that have to be considered. I would add on that I think an active surveillance and testing program is a very important and good strategy, but it still does not replace the need for good behaviors and good public health practices even beyond it. They should go hand in hand. That yes, a negative test does not mean, oh, good, I now don't have to worry about a face mask, and no, good, no longer do I have to ignore social distancing. No, all those things still have to go together and have to be put in, and there should be no false sense of security just from more increased testing. But I think that's something that a lot of places are really trying to do a good job of reiterating to make sure that those good public health practices stay, even with more routine testing.
Well, I can feel the egg running down my face. I thought we were talking about actual pools because I wanted to ask this question about sports. Decisions around sports have gotten a lot of attention. How are different sports organizations handling this?
So sports are challenging. Everybody loves sports. We see a lot of enjoyment and value in them. But sports also include risks, and some sports are going to be riskier than others. Again, we said that there were transmission in schools. We've already seen that transmission exists in sports. Even a multi-billion-dollar industry, the MLB, had trouble with is having trouble with outbreaks as well. So in clusters, it's just going to happen. And so I think it requires a little bit more kind of fine-grained thought about what sports are putting people at the highest risk and how to mitigate within them and what modifications are allowable and can be put in to still, you know, enjoy competition, but at the same time keep everybody safe and healthy.
I mean, how do you think, though, that sports should handle things right now? What's the safest way to do it?
Well, we're still learning from some of the, I think, experiments that are going on, right? So Josh mentioned the MLB experiment, which does not seem to be working that great so far. Meanwhile, the NBA, right, has quarantined all of the players to kind of a bubble at Disney World, and they seem to be doing fine. We don't hear stories about outbreaks or multiple players of an NBA team getting the disease. So I think that, you know, you have to, again, go back to kind of some of the fundamentals of public health. So they're limiting, right, the exposure of the players to outside entities. Eventually, I think that all of the sports will want to come back and have very safe environments that involve fans. The fans, of course, certainly want to go back to those venues. So we have to find ways to do that safely. I think given kind of the state of where the U.S. is today, though, with the rise in cases, it does not make sense right now to bring fans back. If the virus were more under control and we weren't seeing, you know, large outbreaks and people were more accustomed to, you know, social distancing and proper behaviors like in hygiene and face covering, for example, then perhaps we could return back to fans being in the stands. We almost got there with the IMS, but given, again, the situation, the IMS decided to back away from its plan, even though they had put together a fairly comprehensive plan to keep the 25% of fans that were going to come safe. In the end, they decided to back away from that out of fear of outbreak, given the situation
in Indianapolis and the surrounding area.
Shandy Dearth, we got a comment from Timothy on Facebook who says, why don't we just come out and say, if you refuse to wear a mask, you are preventing Indiana from getting out of this crisis. The people who are complaining the loudest are the ones who proudly refuse to mask. By the way, I'm an Indiana public educator, 1 year short of retiring, and I almost quit when we need experience the most, Timothy says. Shandy, there's a balance that needs to be struck, I guess, where public officials are concerned on mask mandates, I guess.
So I have to say I'm sorry about his frustration, but I understand where he's coming from. But he's somewhat correct in that we could really reduce transmissibility if we all were wearing the face coverings correctly, and that's why we needed to do the state mandate. So just encouraging people to wear a mask was not working. We saw lots of people out in public in large settings, large gatherings, not social distancing and not wearing a mask. So that's where those mandates need to come into play. And you've heard Dr. Fauci and some others say we have to have across the country mask use and social distancing in order to bring these numbers down. And I think that line of thought is correct in that if we had those right behaviors, we shouldn't have to just rely on surveillance and find the case after the case already occurred. We should rely on behaviors to prevent the case from happening in the first place. So I kind of agree with the Facebook comment that was left on this, is that we really need to look towards behavior more right now. We don't have a great cure. We don't have a vaccine yet. And so it's really up to us to bring these numbers down so that we can keep some things open, some businesses open going forward over the next few months until we have the cure and until we have the vaccine.
Well, okay, Shandy, so where are we at with a progress with progress toward a vaccine, would you say?
So right now there are three companies either in phase three or close to phase three of vaccine trials. So hopefully we will have something being produced early next year. I'm hoping in the spring we will be ready to start distributing vaccines. Again, we're not going to have enough for everyone right off the bat. So I would expect that CDC would have some priority groups set as to who can receive the vaccine first, just as we saw in 2009 during the H1N1 outbreak.
Priority groups, how might that work? Who, I guess, do we expect to be at the top of those lists?
So what CDC will typically look at is who has the highest mortality rates, who's most at risk of the disease, that sort of thing. In H1N1, we saw it was the younger, healthier adults, people with asthma, people who were obese, and pregnant women who were most at risk during H1N1. That's been different here with coronavirus. So obviously we've seen a much higher mortality rate with the elderly, with people with heart and lung conditions, that sort of thing. So I would expect that CDC will probably come out with a priority list towards those groups first. And then once we have enough distribution for everyone, it will be open to all of the population.
Brian Dixon, we've got just about a minute left, but I wanted to make sure I put this in front of you. How important is it that people collecting and analyzing data about the pandemic also have an intimate understanding of epidemiology, or at least work with people who do? Does that happen enough?
I don't think that happens enough. I think one of the things we've seen is that there are a lot of armchair epidemiologists out there who are trying to make sense of the numbers and sometimes getting it wrong. I think that it's really important to work with, at minimum, someone who has some expertise in understanding healthcare data. I mean, even amongst health experts like myself and Josh and Shandy, we often, you know, have discussions about what the latest trends or information is telling us, right? So we work with each other, we call that the peer review process, to kind of collectively try to come to some consensus around what the numbers mean. And so for an individual person to make some assumptions based on just some numbers or a particular bar chart or something like that can be devastating. Certain groups have put out, in fact, guidance on best practices for interpreting data during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Brian Dixon, I want to thank you for your time today. You're Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regenstrief Institute and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at IUPUI. Shandy Dearth is Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at IUPUI. Josh Vest is an Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Public Health Policy at IUPUI. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you for listening. This is All In.